This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Thursday, time to talk about all things municipal and Olivia Chow's budget for 2026 for Toronto has passed and the very low 2.2% property tax hike is benefiting her approval rating. Even though, frankly, in my opinion, what that number shows is the age-old all-party political gambit, which is buying our votes with our own money. Now, the only declared mayoral candidate, Brad Bradford, well, his approval rating is going up too, but he has a lot to catch up with, and he is part of our panel today, so we will talk to him about that. Now, the question, where does government get money for all the things? Well, it turns out that the city has issued more than $2 million worth of parking tickets during this snow emergency. And I have to say, I got one of those very big tickets, which I am fighting on the advice of Councillor Mike Cole, which he gave me while we were on air a couple of weeks back. And I just want people to know I am not one of the idiots blocking a snowplow from clearing a curb and a sidewalk. That's not at all what was happening when I got my very large ticket. So we'll talk about those tickets and whether there are a lot of other people who are going to clog up the snow-piled streets with fighting the tickets. And another thing that I would like to get some comments from the panel on, as we reported this week, Gord Perks. Again, in my opinion, a holier-than-thou, unctuous councillor. He's also the head of the housing committee at City Hall. It turns out that a building he owns has serious building code violations. And his explanation for this is that it has had these violations for many years. I mean, it leaves me anyway shaking my head. So, text line 866-740-4740. Again, 866-740-4740.
And now, it's time to tune into the town.
And now I'd like to welcome John Burnside, City Councillor for Ward 16, Don Valley East, Brad Bradford, Toronto City Councillor for Ward 19, Beaches East York, and a mayoral candidate, and former Toronto City Councillor Karen Stintz. Hello and welcome to you all.
Hello.
Great to be part of the panel.
Okay, well, it's great to talk to you all. Let's start with Brad and these approval.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. So I have to say I'm a little bit mystified that this budget has helped the mayor in her approval rating. What's your take on that, Brad?
Oh, sorry, I didn't hear you there.
Okay.
Well, look, I mean, people like an inflationary tax increase. And make no mistake, Olivia Chow, as you suggested, is trying to buy Torontonians' votes. She's hoping that you see 2.2% this year and forget about the record-breaking tax increases of 9.5% and 6.9% in the years prior. The way that she's done this with the magic math is a one-time raid on our reserve accounts to the tune of $1.7 billion. But, you know, make no mistake on that front either. Those bills are going to come due, and she is kicking the financial can down the road to after the election. I asked our chief financial officer during the budget process, you know, for a $550 million raid on the reserves, one-time funding, what would it take in terms of tax increases to replace that? And he was very clear. That's about a 10.5% tax hike to replace that. So, you know, we always use reserves every year in the budget. But what was unprecedented was the size and the scale of that rate on the reserve accounts. And, you know, John Burnside's been very clear on this as well. Those are for emergency situations. And I don't think Olivia Chow's re-election prospects in the fall constitute an emergency for most Torontonians.
Okay, well, John, yes. I mean, she denies using the reserves more than in the usual way. But on Monday, we were talking to Lauren Bozanov, pollster, and he was also saying, and again, this had me scratching my head because it was a case of things looking good because of the lowest possible expectations, and that the relatively clean launch of the Eglinton Crosstown was a win for Olivia Chow. I mean, what do you think of that?
Well, there's a whole lot of questions there, but, you know, one of my favorite terms is what they call anchoring bias. You know, people have a number in their head and they can't get that out of their head. So in the case of the mayor, everyone thought that the tax increase was going to be 5, 6, 7%. And when it comes in at 2, they're pleasantly surprised, and that's going to help her. And I don't think that's unexpected. In terms of the Crosstown LRT, the city does get the blame, even though they didn't build it. So, you know, if she's going to get credit for that, then I don't have a huge issue. In terms of rating the fund, she's definitely gone more than in the past. So it's disingenuous to say that she, for those who say she hasn't, to say that. You know, I asked about the TTC the very question. They used to have a $99 million emergency fund. At the end of next year, it's going to be down to $15 million. And the CEO candidly admitted that they were asked to take everything to bare bones. So if he got that order, guaranteed everybody else did. But, you know, it is an election year, and that's, to Brad's point, I guess that's what constitutes an emergency.
Yes, an election emergency, Karen. So we have Olivia Chow apparently benefiting for, again, buying our votes with our money and benefiting from both that budget, which comes on the heels of historic tax increases, and apparently the clean launch of Eglinton Crosstown.
Well, I would just...
I'm not seeing Libby there anymore.
I would just like to say campaigns matter. And I can speak to it very personally. Because,
wait,
you know,
we have just a minute. We have an echo on Karen's line. Try again, Karen.
I think I still have the echo.
Okay. Karen, let's try a third time.
Okay, third time's the charm. There we go. I would just like to, you know, say that these poll numbers are a moment in time. And I don't think that they're predicting where the city is going to be come election day. And I have firsthand experience about how campaigns matter. And when I was, you know, running federally, we were going into that campaign and people were measuring the drapes. At the end of that campaign, it was a very different outcome. So I think that, you know, Torontonians might be feeling good because the LRT opened and it's actually been running for 5 days. That's great. They might feel pleased that the tax increase is moderate, given all the other pressures they're facing. But I would not translate that into support for Olivia Chow continuing on as mayor. I think this is going to be a critical election for the city. And I think that we really do need to be bold in our ambitions because the city is in a lot of trouble. And, you know, we hear about how our economy is not doing well, that we're not keeping up, that people who live in Toronto are falling behind and kids can't get jobs. There is a wealth gap that's severe. And so there's a lot of warning signs to the person running for mayor to say, you know, this ship is not going in the direction we want it to go, and it needs to be turned around, and it needs to be turned around with someone who has the energy and the ambition and the vision to do it.
Karen, before we move on, I know that you took a ride on Sunday
on
the Crosstown. Tell us, how did that go?
Well, it was very crowded. I can tell you that. I understand they're not running at full capacity. I took that to mean that they weren't running the number of trains that they could run. I think what it means is that they're not actually running all the cars that they can run. And I assume, I don't know why they didn't put all their capacity in. It doesn't matter. But I will say it ran smoothly. And it was great. I got where I wanted to go. But I certainly hope that they increase the capacity because it was a very, very, very crowded experience.
Okay. I want to follow up on one of the things that Karen was talking about, and that our economy is not doing well. And there is a new study out of the Fraser Institute, which is a conservative think tank, but it also points out that the unemployment rate here is much higher than in the rest of Canada. It's hovering at around 8%, and that's 2.1 percentage points higher than the average for Canadian metropolitan areas. And I think, if anything, things are going to get worse given the trade war. So let me start with Brad. I mean, should you win the election, you know, you're going to have to be dealing with that.
Yeah, but it's time for somebody to take that issue seriously. And over the past, you know, 3 years with Mayor Chow at the helm, we haven't focused very much on the economy, and it's starting to show. We haven't focused on entrepreneurs or attracting talent or creating the conditions where people want to come to this city and invest, bring their time, their talent, their treasure, and try and build something. So that hasn't been, you know, a big part of the budget. That hasn't been part of the agenda. That hasn't been part of her conversations with the premier or the prime minister. And yet 20% of the national GDP runs through Toronto. And so the way Toronto goes, the rest of the country does. And it's very important that we start creating the conditions for people to want to build again. And as Karen was saying, be a city that has ambition again, right? Be a city where we want to attract talent, where we want to attract capital, where we're creating a climate where it's easier to do business in Toronto than the other jurisdictions that we're competing with. Because that's the reality right now, Libby. Toronto is competing with municipalities in the GTA, interprovincially, east, west, across the country, and in fact, around the world right now. And I think the increasing unemployment numbers, particularly with youth, is a reflection of the conditions here in Toronto. It is reflected in the fact that 77,000 people left the city of Toronto last year in a flight for affordability. And those are primarily younger folks. You know, people at the start of their career, people who are trying to raise a family, trying to build something, they're leaving to other marketplaces, and we're losing out on that talent. So, you know, for me, it's having an agenda that responds to that. It's being very clear that it's going to be a priority. And, you know, it means that we have to find our focus at City Hall, and that needs to be top of the agenda.
Okay. Let me give the text line out again, people. What do you think? And who do you give credit to for this lower than usual property tax hike? And does it raise your hackles a bit, or you think, phew? The text line is 866-740-4740. I'd like to hear your thoughts on this. And Karen, I'd like to hear your thoughts on how Gord Perks, whom you used to sit with on City Hall and who is the head of the powerful Housing Committee, has numerous building code violations in his a house that he owns. And he certainly doesn't seem to be owning up to it and doesn't think it's a cause for him to even step down for that committee.
Well, you know, Libby, I love your term unctuous, and I because I think that so accurately describes Councillor Gord Perks. And I, you know, I witnessed him work himself into a lather around this very type of matter for landlords or individuals that had, you know, these types of outstanding building code violations. And it wouldn't be so unbelievable if he wasn't so sanctimonious, but he is, and he's the first one to point a finger at anybody who might have done, you know, committed a sin of some kind, and yet here he is as chair of the Housing Committee and doesn't seem to think it's a problem that he's violating the city's own building codes. So I find it remarkable. I find it remarkable that the mayor hasn't, you know, maybe stepped in to sort of say, you know, here's what we could do to you know, to create some space between you being in this position and the infractions that you have. But, you know, I think it's another sign and symptom of City Hall that has rules for some people and different rules for others. And I think it's a problem.
Well, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't expect Olivia Chow to do anything about one of her allies, John. I mean, shouldn't there be some kind of mechanism when something like this happens? I mean, if you don't have the sense and the, you know, moral, I don't know, your spidey sense to step down from a committee in a case like that?
Yeah, I'm going to give him a little bit of a break here for the very reason that I don't necessarily expect everyone to know all the building code rules.
But he's
planning
head
and
of,
housing.
But he's head of the housing committee.
Yeah, but how? Right. But that doesn't, the building code is quite a bit. That's a little off on another tangent almost. Housing is about, you know, what's the zoning, how many stories and those sorts of things. So, you know, as I say, I'm not saying he's right. But by the same token, I mean, if the province really, the province dictates when you can get rid of a councillor and they've updated that and it has to be something pretty egregious. You know, if it was something, I think all of us or many of us would have housing building code violations. We moved into homes where things were done and we don't know if they're done properly or not. As I say, he can be very, to Karen's point and I think your point, a little bit on the sanctimonious side, and that's got him into trouble. But absent of that attitude, I don't think it rises to the occasion of firing somebody, even if you could.
Well, I'm not saying fire him as a counselor. I'm saying, you know, have him step away from that committee. Brad, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a position that is a credible one to take. This sort of stuff, particularly building code, it does go through the Planning and Housing Committee. We have those conversations. You know, when we look at different housing types, we talk about staircases, different ways, loading requirements, all that stuff is building code. It does come to the committee. But I think Councillor Burnside is also correct, though. A lot of people are living in old houses with lots of things that have changed and iterated over the years. And you might necessarily not be read up on that. But, Karen's point, Councillor Perks in particular, you know, and I would tell him this, he is one of the most sanctimonious people that, you know, many of us have ever encountered. So this is a situation where it comes across as rules for thee and not for me. Do as I say, not as I do. And that stuff is kryptonite when it comes to leaders. And, maybe it's an opportunity for Gord to sort of reflect on his interactions with the public in particular. And maybe think about how he treats people, because we can all find ourselves in a bit of hot water from time to time, but there is not necessarily a lot of space and grace for people who have been a jerk about it historically.
Okay, well, I do not think that there are rules for thee and not for me. And as I've said, I'm one of many, many people who got one of those snow emergency tickets, and it said park signed, whatever. I mean, it was the afternoon after the big storm. Any sign was covered in snow, and it was in front of a pharmacy, and I was trying to find the safest place behind a great big truck blocking a lot of space. There were, I was giving the city credit for plowing arterials, but there was nothing in sight to get rid of the snow piled there. And I was actually just going to pay the ticket. And Councillor Cole said, fight it, which I'm doing. And so my questions are, first of all, do you expect a lot of people to fight these? Is that going to clog things up? And where does that money go? Does the city get that money from those extra tickets? Who can answer that? John?
Yeah, the city definitely gets the money. Parking tags definitely come into the city coffers. I mean, normally, I think it's about 15 to 20% of people fight their tickets. So, you know, based on that, you're going to have an extra 3,000 or 4,000 people fighting them. Now, I can't speak to your situation, Libby,
no.
But because I wasn't there and I don't know about signs or anything, but when it's emergency snow removal and they've posted the signs and people haven't moved their cars, I think they get 24 hours. I think it's a 24-hour warning. That's a problem, because those same people are the ones that are calling and complaining that we're not removing snow fast enough. Well, guess what? If you have to go around cars, it slows everything down and we can't get to the other sidewalk or the bus stops or the other side street. So, you know, we're all in this together. And if people can't read a sign and or they don't come back, think
to come back for their car within 24 hours. Too bad, so sad is my opinion, but it's up to the court to decide if that's a $100 fine, no fine, or somewhere in between.
Well, it was less than 24 hours, and as I said, no sign, but it's, dare I say...
Well, here's a different situation.
Yeah.
I'm saying for the snow ones.
Dare I say, okay, it's not about me. If you fight a ticket and lose, is there an extra jeopardy on that, Karen?
No, there's not. There's just the ticket. You have to pay the ticket. But I will say that I don't think as a city that, you know, I don't think we have a culture of moving cars when there's snow. I think we have a culture of that we want the snow cleared, but we don't understand necessarily our contribution to that. And I say that, Libby, not based on your experience, but when I was walking to work, I saw a woman, she pulled in the wrong way in front of a coffee shop and in the middle of the snow storm. And I'm like, I asked her, I'm like, you're going to park there? Like, that's the worst place to park, even if there was no snow, but they're coming to clear the snow. And she's like, well, I'm just going to be a minute. I'm like, okay, well, I'm glad your time is worth more than everybody else's. That's good for you. Then I continue my walk down Yonge Street, not a little side street, Yonge Street. Another guy, delivery guy, picking up someone's breakfast. He stops his car right on Yonge Street. I'm like, what are you doing? Right underneath a no parking sign during snow route. Like the sign is right there. And he's like, well, I'm just going to be a minute. And so it's this mentality that, you know, we're not a city that actually understands what our contribution is during these times. And that's why we have people blocking streetcars and we have people parking where they shouldn't park. And, you know, in your case, that there wasn't an awareness because the sign wasn't visible. But I think that there does need to be a collective understanding that you know, during these times when we're trying to get the streets cleared, that we really understand what our part is in that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree with you on that. And like I said, I was just going to pay it until Councillor Cole said, you should fight that. So we'll see what happens.
Libby, can I just add one piece to that?
Yeah.
You know, I agree that we all have a role to play in this, but I think the city has a role to play in it too. And one thing that has confounded me a bit over the past, whatever it is, 2-3 weeks where we've had the snow emergency in place, we have the Green Pea parking app, which is probably the best bit of tech that the city has ever come up with. If it works really well. We also have GPS on all our snow removal equipment. So rather than a blanketed, you know, 3 weeks.
Okay, Brad.
In a lot of places where you need.
Brad, you're breaking up. So try again to finish that thought. Okay.
It'd be nice if they'd eat. Okay.
Okay. Well, hopefully in the next go around, we'll be able to hear what you have to say. And the Green Pea app is great. And, you know, I usually get one ticket a year since the Green Pea app is available because it's so easy and generally it works so well. So thank you, Green Pea app. And I also...
The point I was trying to make, Libby, if you can hear me now, yes, was just that we have GPS on all the snow equipment. So it would be nicer if the city could coordinate that timeline between parking restrictions on the road and where the snow equipment is actually using so that we don't have a blanketed ban for 3 weeks on all the streets at the same time.
Yeah. That among many other things would be nice. I was going to bring up the 311 because, again, so my husband was calling 311 about something and took the option of 311, we'll call you back. And it kept calling him back just with the not connecting to anything, is sort of saying, 311 will call you back. And it goes like in a loop to nothing, just taking up your cell phone time. So are there other issues coming up with 311 in the midst of this emergency, John?
Actually, I can't answer that. I don't actually know. Although I will say that it seems doesn't matter who you call these days, that you're on hold for 2 hours, and then when they finally answer, then you get disconnected. So I think the whole system is very frustrating, whether you're calling about your cable or otherwise. But Brad might have a little more insight into 311 than me.
Okay, Brad.
Well, I just think that 311 is constantly under siege with residents calling in, whether it's snow removal or potholes, sidewalks that haven't been cleared, transit that's not functioning. It's a long list, and that is the sort of compository for everybody to flag issues for the city. But I think we need to level up our game and take advantage of different technology solutions, AI, different things that we can do to triage those calls and ultimately do it in a way where we're delivering better customer service and experience for Torontonians. Because it's not a great experience when you call 311 right now, most of the time. And as you said, Libby, you know, you might be hearing back a couple hours later and not actually even being connected with an operator. So that's not working very well. And there are tons of technology solutions in the marketplace, many of them that were actually built and created here in Toronto that the city has not taken advantage of or attempted to utilize.
Well, I agree with using technology, but I'm smiling because on our to-do list here at Fight Back with Libby Znaimer is a segment on AI customer service fails, some of which are really quite amusing. But, you know, the technology can really mess up a lot, and hopefully it only messes up on things that are not urgent. I'm looking at the clock. We're out of time. This has been a really fun conversation and an important conversation. And I think it is good to note that these polls are really a snapshot in time, and we'll have to see what is there for us next week. In the meantime, thank you so much, Councillor Brad Bradford, Councillor John Burnside, and Karen Stinson. We'll talk again soon.
Thanks, Libby.
I know.
Okay. Bye-bye. We are taking a break. And when we come back, people, we are heading into Valentine's weekend. And if you're single, if you're looking for romance, well, the place that people go to these days are dating apps. But there seems to be this malaise. People seem to be fed up with those apps, and that seems to be across all the demographics, across all age groups, and we will talk about that when we come back.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back, and of course, we have to acknowledge the terrible tragedy in Tumbler Ridge, British Columbia, that resulted in the deaths of 9 people, mostly children. And it has made us question, raised the question, could this have been avoided, since the shooter had many previous mental health episodes that police were called for, and the question, how did she get access to guns? And for many people in our audience who are grandparents, the questions, even here so far away, how do you talk and when do you talk to your grandchildren about this? So the text line, if you have questions, 866-740-4740. And now let's bring in Dr. Oren Amate, who is a registered psychologist here in Toronto. Oren, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Liv.
So people have all these questions. So if you're a grandparent, and I know that a lot of people in our audience are grandparents, when and how do you talk to a grandchild who, you know, might hesitate to talk to their parent about this or might be hearing something from their friends?
Right. Well, first of all, you let the child guide you. You find out what they know. You see what they've spoken about already with their parent. You don't want to contradict their parent. Ideally, you would speak with their parent, your child, before speaking with them, just to make sure, again, that you're not saying anything that contradicts what they've been told. And of course, you keep it age appropriate. And the most important thing, and I apologize for my voice, I'm fighting a cold here, but the most important thing to keep in mind is the child needs a sense of stability, safety, security, and control. As hard as it may seem in these situations, that's what you're trying to convey to them, those factors.
And how do you do that?
Well, you first of all, as I said, you keep it at age appropriate. So you don't tell them too much information. You let them know that these things are incredibly rare. You don't diminish or dismiss what they're feeling. If they feel a bit scared, if they're wondering, you know, could this happen here? You say, I understand. Of course, it's a terrible thing that happened. It's scary. But you say, again, these things rarely happen. You tell them that, you know, there are safety, you know, their safety's in check. You let them know that the adults are in control. And you try to make them, you know, give them this sense of, you know, there are protections out there. And you tell them, you ask them, you say, you know, do you hear the fire engines ever, you know, frequently? Do you see the police cars over there? You try to get them to focus on the, you know, the things in their environment that reinforce this idea that, by and large, they are safe.
You're saying a sense that the adults are in control, but clearly the adults there were not in control. And I'm assuming that at a certain point, preteen or teen, young people, children will realize that.
Yes. And, you know, among adults, I mean, I am outraged whenever I see things like this that, you know, either could have been prevented or mitigated. We don't know how yet. We don't know all the details, but that's an adult conversation. And you're right, for teenagers, they may ask, well, if the adults were in control, how did this happen? And again, you don't dismiss, you don't lie. You say, unfortunately, sometimes the system doesn't work as it's supposed to, but you say, by and large, it does, which is why you say we don't see these things happening, you know, more often than we do. Again, you're not lying to the child. You're just trying to help them frame things in a way that does give them an underlying sense of security, because the alternative is they're going to be flooded with anxiety.
So aside from individual differences, can you give us a sense? So what is appropriate and what is likely to be top of mind for someone who is a preteen, who is, what, 11, 12, as opposed to somebody who is a young teenager versus an older teenager?
Well, especially given that the, you know, the age of the children that were unfortunately targeted, or I don't know if they were targeted, but they were unfortunately killed, was around 11 or 12. Those children might feel particularly vulnerable. But that either whether a child of that age or a bit older, you help them understand. Well, you try to empower them. You try to kind of encourage self-agency. You say, if you see something that looks suspicious, that looks concerning, talk to somebody, whether it's a teacher, principal, police, yourself. You know, you're trying to give them the sense that if there is something wrong, that there is something that they can do rather than be a passive victim. You don't want them to feel like, again, that they are a victim just waiting for something terrible to happen. And that could be at any age, even 5 or 6 years old. You know, there's not much that they can do, but we talk about children, you know, stranger danger, children, you know, like running to a safe adult or something if you see a stranger approaching that seems, you know, like questionable. So we try to empower them at any age, and especially 11 or 12 or 14 or 15, they do have the wherewithal to understand that and do something about it.
And what should parents and grandparents expect? I'm assuming that some children will display a lot more anxiety, especially maybe around sleep time, having nightmares at night or anything like that. What would you anticipate as a result of this?
Well, you always look for significant changes in the child's behavior, demeanor, attitude. So if you are seeing these kinds of changes, it's being patient. It's recognizing that even, you know, as an adult, we would have very different ways of coping with this and processing it than a child would. So we have to understand that they may be, you know, grossly exaggerating the risk, that which can be seen in, you know, their sleep disturbances, for example. So once again, we don't minimize, we don't shame them. We just try to help them contain what they're experiencing. We talk to them about it. And if they need to see someone, you know, for this, you try to get help, whether through the school or, you know, family doctor or you know, directly through a psychologist.
Okay. Dr. Oren Amate, thanks so much for that.
Thank you very much. And, you know, I really appreciate that you are covering topics like this because parents, grandparents, you know, they have a big challenge on their hand in helping children to deal with this because the children are exposed to this. Everyone has a phone or access to this kind of information. And I'm sure lots of kids have heard this. So I think it's so important to have these, you know, measured discussions about it. So thank you.
Thank you. That's all the time we have for Fight Back with Libby Znaimer for today. Free for All Friday is coming up tomorrow. And people, we are going to have a big surprise for you then. So please stay tuned to Free for All Friday coming up tomorrow. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer. And we will talk then.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.